Okay, well, it's great to have the opportunity to come and participate in the workshop this year. I was actually part of the inaugural workshop 2 years ago. I had the privilege of participating in that. It's great to be able to participate in this workshop as well. What I'm going to be looking at today, it's not moving. Right. How do I advance it forward, Sean? It's not moving forward. Okay, what I'm going to be looking at today is the evaluation of target date mutual funds. And just give a sort of brief overview of the agenda for the talk today. I'm going to give some background on what exactly are target date mutual funds. I'm going to review methodologies that are used for evaluating conventional mutual funds. There are some similarities, there are a lot of differences between them. I'm going to, again, be looking at what's different with target date mutual funds from conventional mutual funds. I'm going to review some methodologies that have been used in the past to try to evaluate target date mutual funds. Some of the things that they do are correct, but some of them are not, and they kind of miss it as far as evaluating the funds. And then finally, I'm going to summarize with some things that need to be considered in coming up with a solution on how to evaluate target date mutual funds. So some background. Target date mutual funds have been around about 10 years in the United States, less in Canada. Some of you may have seen the ads for Fidelity's ClearPath solution, where the guy gets into his car and hits the automatic incline for the seat and the steering wheel, and when he gets home, he just claps and the lights go off. So everything he likes around him, it needs to be automatic, and that's kind of what target date mutual funds are, too. You don't have to keep going to your advisor every year or even more frequently to revise how you've invested to save for retirement. It kind of is on autopilot, and it kind of does it for you over time. They are an extension of what are called fund-of-fund mutual funds. Fund-of-fund mutual funds basically bundle together a bunch of mutual funds that are exposed to different asset classes, and usually they target a specific allocation to stocks and bonds. For instance, a balanced fund might be 40% bonds and 60% stocks. But the basic idea with fund-of-funds, and that's why it's called that, it's a fund whose component parts are mutual funds as opposed to stocks. So you bundle together a bunch of funds. Unlike most fund-of-fund products, target date funds continually adjust the equity exposure over time. 40 years before retirement, they might have 80 or 90% exposure to stocks and the rest would be bonds. As you move towards retirement, they reduce the equity weight. Until at retirement, they might have 40 or 50% exposure to stocks and the rest to bonds. Some providers, once you get to retirement, the equity weight is constant from that point forward. Other ones continue to reduce it after you retire so that your weight in stocks at the age of 65 is higher than it would be, say, at the age of 75 or 80. There is no consensus in the investment industry as to what is the, quote, best way to roll down the equity weight over time. I'm just going to show a sample slide here. This one's a little bit dated. It's about a year out of date. These are target date mutual funds in the United States. There's a few of them there that start up at 100% equity weight. This is 45 years before retirement, 35, 25, 15, 5 retirement at this point, and then you continue to roll on into retirement. Some start up at 100%, some are down at 80%. This particular one is down at just over 70% 35 years before retirement. The equity weight at retirement, this is 50% here, so some are as high as 65%, some are as low as about 25%. Again, some are constant in retirement, some continue to reduce the weight until a particular point. This one here continues to reduce the weight, keeps going and going and going. So there isn't much consensus within the industry as to what is the right way to adjust the exposure to stock over time as you roll towards retirement and then even through retirement. In the United States, yeah?
Sort of natural question I'm going to ask you.
Sure.
If there's no consensus on how to roll it, what does it mean to say that there's a consensus that you do roll it? In other words, there's got to be some kind of consensus that you're making some change there. Do you
There is a sort of an intuition that as you are further from retirement, if you're 20, 25 years of age, you have more time. If you're exposed, have a higher exposure to stocks, and stocks don't do quite as well, you have time to recover. You're going to keep contributing to your retirement portfolio. Whereas a person who is just short of retirement, if the market has a severe correction, has a negative 10, 20% return, your $800,000 that you had saved all of a sudden is, you know, worth 75% as much, and now you don't think you're going to have enough money for retirement. That's actually a misconception to think that time somehow reduces the risk of equities. It's actually an issue of the person's, what's referred to as human capital, which is the present value of your future earnings. If you win the lottery at the age of 20 and you've got $10 million, your optimal allocation pretty much is just a constant equity weight. It's only because you're continuing to contribute over time. You're earning money through whatever work that you do, and you're continuing to contribute, and generally speaking, those contributions go up as you get towards retirement. Sometimes they turn down right at the end, but it's the fact that you're earning money and contributing more and more and more, progressively increasing percentages, that actually leads to it being optimal to have a higher equity weight further from retirement and a lower equity weight close to retirement. So the common intuition actually is incorrect, that I've just got more time in case the market has a downturn, it's going to recover, and I've still got time to recover before retirement. It's actually a misconception. It's the present value of your future earnings and how that varies over time that actually leads to this making sense that it should be higher weight well back from retirement and lower weight at retirement. But the issue is, what's the right level of equity, and what might determine the right level of equity for a particular individual? Okay, does that make sense?
I'll ask you.
Okay, great. Now, in 2006, the federal government in the United States introduced a revision to the Pension Protection Act that redefined what a qualified default investment alternative could be for a defined contribution plan. So a defined contribution plan, some of your earnings goes into the plan, your employer matches to some degree the contributions that go into the plan, but it's up to you as the employee to determine, what do I want to invest that money in for my pension for when I retire? The pension plan sponsor is responsible for giving you a sort of a suite or a group, a collection of funds in which you can invest. It has to be fairly broadly diversified because people are different. You might want to invest in one fund, someone also wants to invest in a different fund. But the Pension Protection Act revision in 2006 made target date funds acceptable as the default alternative. So if you as the employee, you're getting this money from the company plus some is being taken out of your paycheck, it has to be invested in something. If you don't make a decision, they invested in the default choice for you. So a lot of pension plans now have target date funds as their default choice. The problem is the plan doesn't know what's the best target date fund out there, because all these equity weights are different and they roll down differently, and they don't know how to evaluate them. What's the best one I should include as part of this defined contribution plan? So that's really why it's become an issue just in the last couple of years, that a lot of defined contribution plan sponsors, that the usual default used to be a money market fund, which is government T-bills that mature in 60 days, 90 days, and you just keep rolling it over. Well, the problem is that's getting you such a low rate of return. It's relatively safe, but it's getting such a low rate of return that when you get to retirement, all of a sudden you realize, oh, I've got $400,000 saved and I need $1 million. Why didn't you tell me I needed to take on more risk to generate more wealth? So a money market fund will not get the average person to retirement. So you need to take on more risk. Target date funds are primarily now being chosen as the default choice. But again, the issue is, how do we evaluate them? Which one is the best? Which one are better than a different one? So that's really what's become an issue in the last couple of years. There have been several attempts by both practitioners and academics to introduce a methodology to rank target date funds. And we'll look at several of them in a few slides, but as yet there is no consensus within the industry as what is the right way to evaluate target date funds. So that's really what the problem is for the week. Okay, briefly review some methodologies that are used for conventional mutual funds. They're evaluated by companies such as Morningstar. Net of fees, so you subtract out all the fees the manager charges, so that's the value you actually get as the investor. You don't see the value before the fees, you see the value after the fees. Net of fees based on a performance benchmark, which is some mix of asset classes. For a balanced fund, it's 40% bonds and 60% stocks, and in Canada it's called the DEX Universe Bond Index, represents the bonds, and the S&P/TSX Composite would represent the equity, and you bundle them together, 40%, 60%, that's the benchmark for a balanced fund. And they're also evaluated based on a rank within a peer group for several different time horizons, for both, relative to the benchmark and relative to the peer group. They'll look at 1 and 3 months, they'll look at year to date, they'll look at 1, 3, 5, 10 years out to see how do they perform relative to each other. Other than the fact that funds in a particular peer group have similar equity and geographic exposure, it may be a global balance fund, has exposure to equities in the US and in Europe and in Japan, or it could be a Canadian balance fund, it only has exposure to Canadian stocks, for instance. So other than the fact that for a particular peer group they have similar exposure to stocks, say 60% for a balanced fund, similar geographic exposure, let's say global, so worldwide, there's no attempt to risk adjust returns when comparing different members of a peer group. Now, to some extent, they're kind of similar. If an investor wants a balanced fund, he has a certain level of risk aversion. So, to some extent, the risk of the funds should be similar. If they're 40% bonds, 60% stocks, and they have geographic exposure, they will be somewhat similar in risk, but they won't be exactly the same. To evaluate the funds, you should really adjust for the risk. There's a basic tenet of finance that, generally speaking, to get higher returns, you need to take on more risk. So a manager may be getting continually higher returns, but he's doing it because he's taking on more risk. You should adjust for the risk when you compare the two managers. The reason for ranking funds relative to peers is in part to attempt to rank the relative skill of the managers. The reason for ranking funds relative to a passive benchmark is to estimate the value added by active management. I could just go out and invest in index funds which have much lower fees and get the same exposure to the asset classes. So presumably the manager is doing something to add additional value, which is why he charges a higher fee. So you have to address the issue of how much value is the manager adding through his actively managing the portfolio, looking at stocks, bonds on a daily basis, buying and selling. He's differing his portfolio from the benchmark. That active management should be adding value. He's charging a higher fee. It should be adding extra value.
Can I ask a question about
sure.
The fee? Is the fee that he charges made available to the client? You seem to imply what you said before, the fee got taken off and you only got told what was left over.
They have to quote the management
fee.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's not a negative penalty against the fee, is there?
A negative penalty in the sense of...
But if he does a lousy job,
generally speaking, no. The idea is if he charges a high fee and he does a lousy job, you're going to go someplace else. So it's to his advantage.
The cost of changes.
Right. Right. But generally speaking, for most mutual funds, there's not a performance-based fee. He doesn't make a higher fee if he does better and a lower fee if he does worse, generally speaking, for most mutual funds. Okay, so there are issues here with an adverse selection problem. Is he a skillful manager or is he a lucky manager? And there are also issues with moral hazard, which he's charging a fee. Is he actually doing anything for that fee? Two managers may charge the same fee. One really works hard, tries to gather additional information. The other one just kind of looks at news wires to try to get the information everybody else gets. So he doesn't actually work harder to try to get better information. Now, ex post, after the fact, it would have been best to invest in the manager with the highest total return. So to determine the appropriate investment ex ante before the fact, funds should be evaluated on a risk-adjusted basis. So you can't just look at a fund and say, oh, he had the highest return, I'm going to invest with him, because he may have taken on significantly more risk. Okay, after the fact, if you want to rank them, saying by who had the highest return last year, and that is done. What was the highest returning balanced fund in Canada last year? They do that. But it doesn't mean, oh, he had the highest return, I should invest with him. You need to look at how much risk did he take on to get that return and adjust for the risk to see how much extra value was added. Okay, the issues with conventional mutual funds are, was the average asset allocation, which is known as the strategic asset allocation, so broadly the allocation to Canadian bonds, global bonds, Canadian equity, U.S. equity, European equity, Japanese equity, etc. Was it efficient? Was it minimizing the risk for a given level of expected return, or was it maximizing the expected return for a given level of risk? Is it an efficient trade-off of risk versus return? Two, did the manager's deviation from the strategic sort of long-term allocation through market timing, he chooses particular asset classes to give a higher weight to and others to give a lower weight to, because he thinks one's going to outperform and one's going to underperform. And security selection, he doesn't go out and invest in Canadian stocks as an index, he chooses particular stocks, so he has to actually select securities within the index. Did that add value net of fees on a risk-adjusted basis? So he's making active decisions to overweight, say, overweight stocks, underweight bonds. That's an active choice on his part. Did it add value? He's choosing particular stocks and particular bonds. Did that add value relative to just allocating to an index fund that tracks the relevant index, bond, stock, etc.? Okay, what's different with target date funds from conventional mutual funds? Investments in conventional mutual funds are usually considered to be single period in nature. For instance, 1 year in length, which you would review it on an annual basis, but you're allocating for the next year. The objectives of the fund reflect this. Maximizing return for a given level of risk, minimizing risk for a given level of return, etc. And so do the metrics for performance measurement. What's called the Sharpe ratio, you want to maximize it. What's called the information ratio relative to a benchmark, you want to maximize it. Those are all inherently single period measures of performance. Investments in target date mutual funds are inherently multi-period in nature, and they involve contributions to the fund pre-retirement and also withdrawals from the fund in retirement. Also, since they cover the full life cycle of the individual, it's generally considered important to consider all forms of wealth, not just financial wealth, but human capital, present value of your future earnings, insurance against catastrophic loss of human capital. If all of a sudden you have a debilitating disease or an accident that cripples you, you're not going to get that future income. Are you insured against it? That's a considerable risk that you need to take into account. Illiquid real estate holdings. You own a house. If you have a mortgage, it's leveraged. That's already invested in real estate. Do you want to be putting more real estate in your retirement savings, or should you be investing away from that? So when determining an optimal strategy, these are things you should take into account. However, target date funds are generally designed as though the investor's wealth is made up of financial wealth and human capital only. They don't consider insurance. A lot of people would say you need to, but they're designed assuming somebody is not insured, and they make no assumption about a person's real estate holdings. So a person, essentially, they assume has zero real estate, you don't own a home, and you're just allocating your financial wealth and your future income wealth to save for retirement. DC pension plan sponsors that intend to select a target date suite as the default option for their plan currently have no objective means of ranking target date suites of funds, since, as we'll see later, an investor's ranking will depend on his or her aversion to risk and also their labor income process. The labor income risk, is your income nice and steady, or does it go all over the place because it's performance-based or what have you? The correlation to market risk, does your income go up when the market goes up, and does it go down when the market goes down, or does your income go up when the market goes down and vice versa? So that should be taken into account. And the probability distribution of these investor characteristics, risk aversion, labor income, among the DC plan cohort. So the people that are invested in this defined contribution plan would generally not be known by the plan sponsor. They don't know, how many people have risky labor income? How many people have non-risky labor income? What's the correlation on average of the people's income to the market return? What's the average level of risk aversion of the people in the plan? Are the people with high risk aversion, low risk aversion? They generally don't know that information. Okay, so that's part of the problem. The plan sponsor, if they're using it as a default option, I don't know who the people are that are going to be investing in this fund. How do I design something which is in some sense optimal or almost optimal for most people when I don't really know who those people are, so to speak, what they're like in terms of investors? Okay, there's a few previous methodologies that have been used. I'm going to try to go through this quickly because I don't think we have a lot of time here. Lipper is a research shop, so to speak, in the U.S., and they provide research to fund managers, to consultants, to advisors. They've actually had three suggestions on how to rank target date funds. One basically uses a block bootstrap of historical data to generate thousands of potential histories, you know, from 45 years before retirement to 40 years into retirement. And then they just look at how the different funds do. What's the wealth distribution they generate at retirement? How does it look? What's the mean level of wealth? What's the standard deviation of wealth? The problems with this particular way is that historical data may be biased going forward. Most people in the investment industry think that we've had very high returns in the past. People have earned an abnormally high excess return for equity risk, and people think it's going to be lower going forward, which if you're not going to get the return for taking on the equity risk, you probably want to put more into bonds. So if you did use historical data, you may get a biased test. And second, standard deviation really isn't appropriate as a measure of risk for the wealth distribution, because when you've accumulated wealth for 45 years, it's highly positively skewed. So using what is essentially a symmetric measure of the width of a distribution for something that is skewed really is not appropriate. So it's a couple of problems with that method. Another Lipper method uses what's called a Bradley-Terry model. For paired comparison, this model is used to rank professional tennis players, for instance. It's named after Bradley and Terry, who wrote a paper in 1952. It actually was originally created by or discovered by Zermelo in 1929 and rediscovered independently by Bradley and Terry in 52. The problem with this form of ranking is it's inherently risk neutral. It would be appropriate for ranking funds after the fact, not before the fact. And the technique doesn't address the unique characteristics of target date funds. The fact that it's a multi-period strategy is irrelevant as far as this ranking is concerned. You could use the same technique for conventional mutual funds that are single period allocations. So it really doesn't address the issue that target date funds are multi-period in nature. Another one by Lipper uses paired comparison digraphs and introduces a total ordering. The problem is the total ordering is not financially based. It's mathematically unobjectionable, but it's not based on finance, so it really doesn't incorporate risk and return in an appropriate way. And again, it doesn't address the fact that target date funds are a multi-period strategy as opposed to a single-period strategy. The group called Turnstone Advisory Group in the United States produces an annual report called Popping the Hood that looks at target date funds. It's a huge report. It's like 160 pages long or something. They use a score function to rank each target date fund according to four categories: organization, which is a subjective measure, fees and expenses, performance, which is relative to a sort of glide path, that equity roll down that they determine as a benchmark to measure against, and also risk, which refers to the 3-month worst return on the fund historically, which is kind of an arbitrary measure. The scores are then aggregated according to 6 weights. The organization, one number one, has 10% weight. The others all have 30% weight. Organization refers to, it's a moral hazard adverse selection issue. What's the corporate governance like in the asset management firm that's offering the fund? Are there directors on their board mostly independent of the company, or are there company people sitting on the board? Things of that sort. do the fund managers invest in their own funds, et cetera. The problem with this is it's, although it's probably the best way to use a score function to evaluate the funds, scoring them in different areas and then sort of totaling it up, aggregating it, the valuation of the scores is biased. Two, the fees are double counted because fees and expenses is one category, and then when they evaluate performance and risk, they do that net of fees, so the fees are counted twice. The glide path that's used, which is referred to as a defensive glide path, if you actually take historical returns and use a block bootstrap, you find that nobody but extremely conservative investors really wants it. So why should performance be measured relative to that? Because it's not appropriate for most investors. There's a group called Target Date Analytics, which is sort of the analytic arm of Turnstone Advisory Group, the previous group. They produce four glide paths, defensive, conservative, moderate, and aggressive, to serve as benchmarks. The glide paths only refer to the accumulation phase. If you use historical returns for block bootstrapping, the defensive and conservative ones are inappropriate for most investors. They kind of imply that you have a very negative view on the market going forward. Dow Jones has a couple of target date series of indexes. One is nominal, so it's based on just the dollar value. One is real return, so it's based on the value adjusted for inflation. They don't make a commitment as to whether one is better than the other. They offer them both. It's a conventional benchmarking exercise. There doesn't seem to be any attempt to optimize the sort of the roll down as you go from one index to the next. So it's kind of, if I'm doing well relative to these benchmarks, what does it mean? Because the benchmark isn't optimized. Morningstar also has peer groups that they use for target date funds. The problem is the categories are too broad. They group them according to the target date. So 2000 to 2014 is one group, 2015 to 2029 is the second group, and 2030 and above as the target date is the third group. The problem is within the groups, you can have a significant variation of risk. For instance, within a given target date suite of funds, so a single provider has a 2010, 2015, 2020, 2025, et cetera fund. The 2015, 2020, and 2025 funds are all in the same peer group. The 2025 fund will have much higher equity weight and hence risk than the 2015 fund, but they're all in the same group. So when the market is turning up, the 2025 fund is going to have a much higher rank than the 2015 fund, and when the market's turning down, it's going to flip the other way. And what does that tell me? It doesn't really tell me anything about those funds. It just tells me how the market's doing, basically. So that's the problem with that method. There's a recent paper by Bodhi and Troussard. They recommend combining a target date fund with a real return bond fund whose duration matches the time to the target date. The latter fund would be considered the risk-free asset for someone who's trying to accumulate wealth at that target date. Given an investor's level of risk aversion and volatility of labor income, the authors assume that labor income and market returns are perfectly correlated, which is an unrealistic assumption. The optimal strategy is some combination of the target date fund and the real return bond fund. The certainty equivalent real wealth of the target date fund, which means what? It means what wealth am I willing to accept with certainty? Am I indifferent between getting a certain level of wealth at retirement with certainty? You're telling me you get $800,000 and you get it for sure, absolutely guaranteed, or I get this distribution of wealth. At what point am I kind of indifferent between getting a spread of potential end-of-period wealth or getting a particular level with certainty? That's the certainty equivalent level. So they compare the certainty equivalent level for the optimal strategy to what you would get with a target date fund, and it gives a number between 0 and 1, and they use that to rank. Now, it wasn't their intention to rank target date funds by themselves, but you can actually use that certainty equivalent methodology to compare different target date funds for a given investor. The problem is this method is solely focused on the accumulation phase, not on the distribution sort of post-retirement phase. And the model assumes that labor income and market returns are perfectly correlated, which is not a realistic assumption. Okay, last one is a paper by, a 2005 paper rather, by Coco, Gomez, and Manhout. They analyzed life cycle saving and consumption in a multi-period model incorporating stochastic labor income and proposed this rule as sort of an optimal benchmark. You got 100% equity weight until the age of 40, then it drops down in a straight line to 50% at the age of 60, and then it's 50% constant from that point onward. They say this is, it's not an optimal strategy, but it's close to optimal for many investors, and they propose that as a benchmark. Okay, so that's, we've looked at some previous solutions. None of them really address the problem fully and completely. Yeah, Tom. They're basically evaluating the glide path. Yeah. So, but you can think of the way most target date funds work. If I invest in the 2040 fund, 5 years later it's going to look like the 2035 fund, and then 5 years after that it's going to look like the 2030 fund, et cetera, until I hit retirement. So, if you evaluate the fund suite in a certain sense, you're evaluating the whole glide path. So, some things to consider in the solution to the problem. The goal of a target date suite of funds is to transfer wealth from the accumulation period to the distribution period in order to support a consumption plan and possibly a bequest plan. You want to leave money to your kids, grandkids, whatever. An evaluation methodology should therefore focus on the ability of the target date fund to meet these goals, i.e. minimize the risk of not meeting the goals in a certain sense. Most of the approaches mentioned above only address the ability to accumulate wealth at retirement. This can lead to a situation where the recommended strategy has a lower equity weight pre-retirement than it has post-retirement, which none of the academic models say is right, to all of a sudden go from 20% equity weight just before retirement to I should be up at 50% at retirement. It kind of doesn't make sense that there's a jump like that. For an investor, the selection of a target date fund is really an auction. This is the way you can think of it from an economic standpoint. It's an auction with a multidimensional scoring function. You've got scores for adverse selection. Is it a skillful manager or a lucky manager? You've got scores for moral hazard. Is he charging an excessive fee and just sitting on his duff and not really doing any work? And the optimality of the glide path, and maybe some additional scores that need to be taken into account as well. With the investor as the buyer in the auction and the target date fund providers as the sellers. That's one way you can think of this problem. The investor's risk aversion, the volatility and correlation of labor income to market returns need to be accounted for in the solution because investors are different. These characteristics differ among different investors. The need for an objective description of asset class returns going forward is a difficult one to meet. History is objective, but the future may not look like the past. What's the future going to look like? Investors, generally speaking, they differ as far as how they think the market is going to behave going forward. I think it's going to be better than historical. I think it's going to be worse than historical. I'm not going to earn any excess return at all for risk, so why would I want, for equity risk, so why would I want to invest in stocks, et cetera. One method to overcome this would be to use current market weights for asset classes to, in a sense, back out the risk premium for each asset class. It's a well-defined method to do that. Doing that, though, requires that you specify a risk premium for the market as a whole. And that will differ among different investors. You might have to consider low equity or market risk premium, middle, medium, and high market risk premium. The paper by Coco et al. Provides a methodology for evaluating life cycle strategies based on the consumption stream that can be supported, but it does not account for the investor's longevity risk. It assumes a particular fixed time horizon, and I can't say that I'll live until my 90th birthday and then drop on the spot. I have no idea how long I'm going to live, so that should be taken into account in evaluating the funds. Finally, DC plan sponsors may not be fully informed about the characteristics of the individuals in the plan's cohort that are in the DC plan. So they might want a measure of how robust a target date fund suite is to changes in investor characteristics in terms of the fund's evaluation. So, generally speaking, a target date fund provider comes up with one suite of target date funds. For investors that have a high tolerance for risk, they may say, I want higher equity weight than you're giving me. For investors with a low tolerance for risk, they may say, I want a lower equity weight. So it's almost a guarantee that it's not optimal for almost anybody. But is it close to optimal for most? So in a sense, they're looking for a robust solution which is close to optimal for most investors. Okay, and that's it. Thank you.